You are now listening to Bigfoot and Beyond, featuring the OG bad boys of Bigfoot, the Dr. Heckle and Mr. Jive of Squatchology, the Chip and Dale of Bigfoot, and I'm not talking about the cartoon. Please welcome your hosts, the Bigfoot celebrity couple, Biff Klobo, better known as Cliff Berrickman and James Bobo Fay.
Welcome to Bigfoot and Beyond, Bart.
Oh, guys. Pleasure to be here, guys. I'm proud of you. I love it.
Just a little background for some of the listeners out there. If you don't know who Bart Catino is, he's a well-respected West Coast researcher. I met him in 2004, the very first BFRO public expedition up in the Humboldt Redwoods. He's been one of my best bros ever since. We actually just were out last weekend together.
Bart has definitely put his time in the field. He has gone through a couple of thermal imagers at this point. I always give him credit as having that thing to his eye more than any other human I've ever seen in my life. He's probably filmed one of these things based on his recreations and analysis at the site. It's very difficult to find out what else it could be if it wasn't a Bigfoot. And this is up at the Sierra location, I believe, if I remember right.
Yeah, Bart actually probably has the best documented follow-up of any Bigfoot footage ever gotten.
Yeah, he put the time in, you know, and which is important because most pieces of footage, I mean, they're not the Patterson-Gimlin film. You know, you can't see that. And Bart's is a thermal video at 105 yards. Yeah. So that's a long ways away. So you can't tell what it is. And it, without the follow-up, without the measurements, without the boots on the ground doing the work, there would be nothing to say about that video. But Bart and his group, you know, put in the time and did the work and came across some interesting discoveries in his own footage.
That night was crazy. And remember, too, we're seeing it, as you guys know. I mean, we use thermal more than anybody, but, you know, you're seeing it at a better resolution live than what it's the inboarding and how it's recording. And it was just, yeah, it was surreal that night. But I couldn't have done the investigation without. I had a lot of help. I had a dozen people with me, half of them law enforcement. We put, you know, our brother Leiterman, Ranger Leiterman, but, you know, took that over, which was perfect. And then, you know, who did a really great job in presenting it was Phil Poling, who's a skeptic. And that's why I kind of handpicked him. And I, you know, just give him everything I've got. I trust this guy to just tell the story as it is. And in 17 minutes, I mean, he did a hell of a job.
Bart's got that interesting thermal video that, you know, isn't the best quality, but the follow-up is the best ever done on, you know, Bigfoot footage. But what's even, there's more backstory on that, is where the footage was taken. Tell about that part.
Yeah, it's crazy. You know, everyone had heard about the Sierra Kills situation with Justin Smea and a friend. There was actually two individuals. And we actually, I mean, I got put on that. That was Bo. You came with me. That was the first time up in, I think it was 2010. We went to the kill site. We had never, you know, on that side of California, we were like, Jesus, why? We've been missing the boat. Like, how do we not been here before?
The whole Sierra site, that whole area, when we hit that in 2010 with Melder and Myachinsky and the Smea thing, I mean, that was never on my radar to research. It's, I look back now and it blows me away how it all went down. Really, the impetus to that was 2 weeks prior to going. So this would have been, you know, I think it was 25th is when I filmed them. So it was about August 10th, 11th or whatever. Actually, Bo, you were with me in Monterey, if you remember, and Roe gave us the call. Justin gave us the call. I just written the polygraph for Justin. They just did the polygraph. He passed it. And then Justin actually took them to that Sierra site. And they weren't even there really to be Bigfooting, whatever. I think they banged on trees, screamed a little bit, did nothing, you know, nothing was going on. And they weren't attempting to do anything. And they ended up just staying the night there. I think it was going to be a day trip. And they had like Nadia with them. There was a few, it was about six people total. Sean was there. Justin, another guy, Carl, and of course, Roe. And, anyway, so I heard that at about 3 a.m, with half of them asleep, I think more than half, it was just Justin and someone else, Carl, awake. And Justin had described it as it sounded like Jurassic Park, like the stomping and the trees. And so they had a significant, it woke everybody up. There was a bipeds that ran away. It was all on the southwest side of camp. It was just totally unexpected. I didn't even know to believe it. I mean, Ben, I remember Bo being with me. We're just shaking our head. So a couple weeks go by, and we had a funeral in our business family. in Visalia. I told my wife, I said, you know, I think I might just, you know, go to the funeral and then mosey up to the Sierra. And she's like, bullshit, you are. You know, it was funny. We kind of fought about that, but I kind of won out on that one, thank God. And we went up and just put a quick trip together. So basically it was a day and a half, I mean, thrown together. Roe and Todd came up. They had just met. I think they had been together just, you know, just recently. They're just from both from SoCal. I had Michael Lorenz there with me, who was a great caster. And then Sean was coming up. This was going to be like his second night in the woods. Well, the first night, I got up there at night. It was just me and Justin. And I remember it was just being a weird night. You know, you just kind of had a little bit of a vibe, if you will. A lot of deer were around. I remember me and him, we stayed up to like 5:30 that night. I was playing guitar and, you know, we ended up crashing and got up early the next morning. Then the guys just started popping up as they went. I don't even think Sean got up there, until like, 10 PM or so. And, we had nothing happen. Of course I was doing all the instigating with the calls, knocks, everything just indiscriminately, you know, and, had nothing happen. And I remember that there were multiple deer herds converged throughout the meadow. I would say within a 2-mile radius, there must have been 5-6 herds converged. I saw probably 80 to 90 deer, the most I've ever seen in any situation. I mean, we were right on top of them, or they were right on top of us, I should say, but they were everywhere. And that's what was different about that night. So anyways, I remember about midnight, I'm starting to just get ready to conk out. Like it's, you know, I barely slept the night before. Nothing's going on. I got to be back early in the morning. I didn't even have my laptop because it was being repaired at the time. So that's how quick and thrown together this all was. So about midnight, I remember Sean, actually it was a little bit later than midnight, but I'm thinking about it. Sean came walking up to me and he's still awake. The guys are starting to conk out. And I just finally looked at him and I said, all right, Sean, I said, let's go break your fear of the dark. You know, it's the second night in the woods. Let's go for a long, you know, go for like a 2-mile hike together. So we go and we were going to kind of, I was going to have him do some calls off the Eastern Vista. And he did. He did them perfectly. And we didn't know it at the time. And it's funny looking back in hindsight, the squatches were already had to already be where they were positioned. I mean, there was no, so they saw this before. What the hell are these guys doing? Right. And it was literally after he did those calls, we round the bend and looked back down towards camp. And I just happened to stop. And I just said, you know, I'm just check the vantage point. We were going to walk the road and go like 3 miles, you know, and come back. And, I look and I had, you know, my auto recorder going and I'm looking down and I'm seeing what looks like bipeds and I'm thinking, okay, I've got two guys asleep down there. My two strongest guys that have been, you know, from experience standpoint, and Justin and Michael, you know, Todd, he's Olympic Project now, but like I said, that was like his second night in the woods. Roe, same thing. So I'm going, wait a minute. And I'm seeing bipedal movement going back and forth. And that's not really, I don't really know the, you know, I don't know the topography that well because I'd only been there, you know, a couple days. You know, I'd walk through it, but, you know, which tree gaps or which or whatever. But it looked like it was from the side of camp. And I'm just filming already, and I'm just whispering to Sean. I go, Sean, if those aren't the guys, those are squatches. Because I can see they're clearly bipeds. And so we're just filming. I just basically whisper. I said, you hold on to my waist. You breathe when I breathe. I kneel. You kneel. Like, and, you know, he was scared because imagine his shoes. This guy is a, you know, he's got a big Bigfoot blog. He's not an outdoors guy. That's his second night in the woods. He couldn't even believe something like this could happen. But he's holding on to my waist, shaking at first, you know, and he can't see what I'm seeing. I'm just describing to him what I'm seeing. And anyway, so these things, they're walking back and forth. I made the decision pretty quickly. Like, you know, I've got a bunch of like empty footages where I'm trying to go right, trying to go left, trying to see them in any other gap. It was the only window I had them in. And remarkably, they would disappear like sometimes 2-3 minutes at a time. So you didn't know, is that it? I mean, is that, so there's still for a little bit, there was a question in my mind. Could it be the guys, you know, could it be where I know I'm like more than 100 yards away. But then as I start seeing them walk back and forth, I start watching the behavior through the gap and I'm like, oh shit. This is, and it just, and psychologically, you know, I was ready and I knew the team I had. I knew what the personnel, the lack of equipment, everything else, what the call was. I run towards those things. I'm flushing them out like they're gone. you know, there's not, I'm not fleshing them out for us to see. I'm fleshing them away. Plus, not to mention how the shaky footage on that and flipping on a light, you know, I made that decision right away and I would do it again. Get as much footage as possible, answer all the questions later. And I'm glad I did because we got some good shots stepping through the gap. I remember at one point we walked back with Sean, actually, because I didn't have the lithiums in that unit yet. We didn't know we can use those yet. So I had batteries dying like within 2-3 hours. And I had two sets on me. And so we wore those out. I had to go back to camp, could not get them in any other window in the trees. And to be fair, when I go back to camp, you hear the audio, you know, I'm talking with the guys and I'm just like, did you, and they were seeing dark silhouettes fill the tree gaps, you know, half asleep, Ro and Todd. And so they were just mesmerized. They couldn't believe it. They didn't hear anything, but they thought they were seeing things and looking up. So when I'm down there in the camp, I'm kind of trying to get them, you know, nonchalant, or, you know, kind of whispering to them. And I'm kind of looking up. And to be fair, looking back now, I never would have thought they were as close as they were. I didn't know until we did the investigation. So I think I was looking past them the whole time. But I could not see them from the bottom. And remarkably, so we loaded back up on batteries. I must have been in a camp 25, 30 minutes, like a long time. And Sean said, let's go back. We'll try to reposition. You never know. They'll come back. Maybe they're still there. We don't know. So we got back in position, and sure enough, there they are. And one of the coolest things was remarkable. I'll never forget, because what it looked like seeing through the therm versus, you know, the onboarding recording, there was like a flash of light and it looked, and I just remember telling Sean, one of them did something because I didn't know what to say. And it turned out that was a rock that was thrown that we didn't know until we had gone back and done the investigation, the rock that ricochets and bounces off the wood. It's the tree. That's the only thing they heard. So we got some more, like, you know, really cool stuff. It's just, unfortunately, from a distance, and the quality is not great. It's 320-240. So eventually they were gone. And I do want to add, there was a 7-footer that was there that was stationary, a 7-foot heat object that was there 20 feet above. We went back, of course, we knew all this from doing the investigation. But that subject was there most of the time, while there's at least two others that were 6'3", 6'4", moving through the gap. It was insane. And it makes you wonder, you know, hearing back from the guys, I didn't know this, but while I was up there filming the squatches, 3 muley deers had come and just loaded in camp and basically just sat next to the guys, like sure sign of predators, you know, around. And then you wonder with the rocks, you know, there's a lot of speculation, but anyways, I finally called it. It was about 3:30 in the morning, and I mean, we just had nothing left. I hadn't seen them for like 45 minutes or so, and then I made the call. I told everyone, you guys pretend we're going to sleep. And I really thought in the end I was going to catch 3 or 4 bipeds descending to the side of that hillside from my vehicle, and it just never happened. We found out later doing the investigation they'd already exited. You even see one of them exit north. It looks like a bipedal person is walking north behind Todd and Roe, gone quietly through the grass. And I woke up, I had the thermal wrapped around my neck. I slept 2 hours. I remember Justin, you know, he had slept through the whole thing, but kind of knew kind of what was going on. Like, he just said, yeah, his thing was like, what do you think? He's like, I guess we're bullshitting you and, you know, brought you here. And now the squatch has showed up. You know, he just wasn't really like surprised, but he was, you know, pretty excited for me. And I remember we drove back, and the hardest part was not being able to review the footage. And it felt so, until I got back to Monterey, 6 hour, 6.5 hour drive by the time you do your stops. And that was so difficult because I felt so naked, because I feel like everything's got to be just investigated properly, due diligence. I just had nothing with me. And that's when we had to, once I got back, saw the footage, I sent it to Kirk Brandenburg first. He was the first one to review it. And then I did with them. And then we went back 3 weeks later. I put a team together. I was going back with the Bumping Lake, where, you know, I saw mine in 07 expedition, and Robert Leiterman and I, we look forward to that trip every year, going hitting the Lala River, all these wonderful places, Oregon, going back and forth, the road trip, and we had to cancel it. And I called everyone back to the site, hopefully to get more footage, but mainly we got to do an investigation. So, and that investigation lasted, I believe, about 10 days, and I had about a dozen guys, give or take 2 or 3 a day, about half of them law enforcement. So, And Leiterman took the lead on that and passed it right to him. He's got a vested interest because, just like you guys, I mean, we're all kind of tied at the hip through our history, and it behooves him to want to know what the truth is. And I knew he'd get down to it, and he would test it to death. And that's exactly what we did, you know, and try to set an example for the field moving forward. Because let's be honest, you guys know the footage is a C minus in quality. Distant thermal, half people don't really understand what they're looking at. It's when you put it all in the proper context with the investigation, you go, oh, okay, they're 6.5 and 7 feet tall, and it's we're at 7,100 feet, and they're naked, you know, and they're not really moving like people, you know. So, and Phil Poling, again, he was instrumental in the investigation. As you know, he put together the 17-minute documentary. I wanted, who's the best guy that does that? And he's a skeptic. I had nothing to hide, so I just gave him everything I asked. And, you know, the investigation, I think backs up what they are. I fully believe that those were Sasquatches, because the alternative would have to be three unknown subjects on the highest end of the human height scale at 7,100 feet, 58% waxing moon, loitering between 1:30 and 3 in the morning at our campsite, you know, and no way of getting up there. So it's, you know, that's really the only alternative we have here. So
Leiterman was there, wasn't he?
No, Leiterman came for the investigation, because Leiterman and I were scheduled to go to, I had an expedition back at Bunk where I had my sighting in 07, and we had to cancel that, and because this happened, and then get, you know, I had to get a team over with me there to do the whole investigation.
And when I say Leiterman, that's Ranger Robert Leiterman with the California State Parks. He's a actual law enforcement. He's got investigation skills.
Yeah, he's been a primary partner, as you guys know, with you too. I mean, he's just an incredible asset, taught me a ton, and very objective. And, you know, he was the perfect guy to do the investigation for that. As I said, as you guys have said, the footage itself, it's a C minus footage until it's put into perspective. And then you see, you know, my guys with their clothes on, you know, I use Kip as the model. Kip Morrow is one of my best friends, who's 6'2". And the subjects were, you know, there's two subjects going back and forth that were in the 6'3", 6'4" range. You know, I had a bunch of midgets with me that night. I was the tallest guy at 6 foot, and I was holding the camera. So it was just, the whole thing was crazy, totally unexpected. But I will say this, I learned, like, watch the vantage points. Where's the vantage points over camp, the human activity, you know, the darkest area, the area where you can go in and you can watch and listen. And, you know, no one would know the better, you know, how many of us are running out there with thermal imaging.
It throws a rock too, right?
Yeah. At one point, you know, this, what's so crazy about this whole thing is I had a couple of guys in camp, two of them sleeping, and two other ones that were, it was Roe and Todd. You know, Todd, he's become a veteran, a little bit of the woods now, but at that time it was like his second night out. And, you know, the first thing that went through my mind, obviously, when I'm looking from my vantage point and I'm filming, is, oh, it's one of the guys. And I even tell Sean in the audio, I'm like, if that's not one of the guys, those are Squatches. And, you know, I knew from watching even more before I even got down to talk to him, but it's all recorded. The good thing is I had the audio running on my head the whole time. You kind of feel like you're there, you know, and poor Sean, it was like his second night in the woods. And he was holding onto my waist the whole time. And I'm just telling him, whispering to him, I'm like, you're going to kneel with me, breathe with me, but change my battery. You know what I mean? It's just, we're together, you know? And then he toughened up as that night went on. I mean, that was this thing lasted like an hour and a half, and I had no other vantage point. I tried every which way to get a different window, and I just had that one window from 105 between V-shaped trees. And then you see in the footage, it looks like a dark, it just looks like a dark tree. But what it is it's nighttime. There's no, the heat doesn't hit that part of the tree. So that's the coldest thing in view. So it almost looks like that's the gap when you're watching it, but it's not. That's the back of the tree. You know, a lot of this stuff we didn't know until we went back 2-3 weeks later and were able to recreate the whole thing. I wasn't familiar enough with the site to know the distance. I didn't know. I mean, for all I knew those things were 8 feet tall, for all I knew they were 5'5".
Yeah, your footage of the series, you actually got some documentation, but you got a much better thermal observation of a Sasquatch several years before that.
Yeah, that was the inspiring one in Bumping Lake, Washington in 07, in the summer. As a matter of fact, I go back every year and spearhead an expedition with the whole Washington crew. It's not my favorite place to be. I love the people that I'm with, but I only go back there because of what happened. And, you know, I'd be stupid not to. I was laughing about this because it's like the first time I ever put a thermal imager in my eye at bumping. And I've done it how many hours since? Hundreds of hours since. I saw one, and then I never saw one. I haven't seen one since there, you know?
Yeah, Cliff. So if you remember, it was, I think it was about midnight or so, and you were kind of rearranging stuff in your truck. Everybody was together. You know, there Paul Graves, Tom, they were all playing guitar. And I asked you, I said, can I, you know, we go take the, you know, take the therm for a walk. And actually, I take that back. How that started was I actually walked back on that small trail pathway. It was pitch black back there. You guys remember that night. And I felt something, just kind of a presence, kind of somewhat close to me. And I heard a step branch break. Didn't think a lot of it, you know, walked back. And that's when I talked. He said, hey, if you got the X200, I'll, you know, poke around with it. And I mean, it wasn't more than, God, it was probably 30 seconds to a minute that I see something bright right down the trail from where I came from. Probably about 60 yards at first, 55, 60 yards. And then I remember the girls were there. I thought it was either Christine or Tracy. And, you know, one of them was trying to relieve themselves behind a tree. Cause you only see 10% of it at first. So, yeah, I saw like the knees and then the head poking out. And then it was doing that kind of right and left looking at me, which looked suspicious, but it's still, my thoughts are person, you know, especially cause we were there with quite a few people and until it stepped out. And then I could see the whole left side all the way down. I mean, down to the calves. And then, you know, basically drop down. As soon as I saw it step out, I mean, it's very clear, you know, that's not a, it's not a person from that distance. And then got on the ground and then not on all fours, but I'll never forget, like knees down, arms extended, and kind of just doing this kind of like a head rotation thing, like trying to lock in on me, but it looked like it couldn't really lock in on me, but it was trying to, which was really curious. And then there was just a bunch of fast transitioning on the ground. I saw a lot, but I guarantee you there's a lot I missed. But it actually made at one point like a digging type motion with its stomach perpendicular to the ground. It was just a weird kind of thing to see. At one point, this is actually, I think, in the beginning of it, I had snapped my fingers trying to get your attention, Cliff. You couldn't hear me. You were putting stuff away. And I'm snapping my fingers going, Cliff. And every time I did that, it was unbelievable to see this thing was like reacting like almost, you know, frightened, like a small dog, like, you know, just a lot of like just unnerved movements. And then it would pause, freeze in between me doing that as if it was scaring it. And you got to remember, they were all down there, right, you know, right on my left, just totally oblivious. And there's all that sound coming from there. But for some reason, you know, it was focused dead on me. And then at some point it had rolled to the side and put this hand up, and, you know, you see all five digits on that splayed hand. It was unbelievable. So if we get back to it, but it took me years later to figure out what it was doing. Cause it made no sense to me. Cause as you guys know, the therm picks up IR. It doesn't give off IR. Right. So anyways, it got back up and I saw it like push, you know, it pushed itself up. Got back down again and then just like got up. I don't even know if it pushed itself up the second time. I don't think it did. I mean, just effortless, the transitioning on the ground using body leverage. But the last, you know, the watching it and seeing its back to me, calves north, I could see everything in the clear. I mean, it was almost literally utopian. And you just see the whole profile of the back, you know, head kind of maybe sunk in a little bit, a little smaller head than I would have thought, but it may be bigger. I just couldn't tell from my positioning, but shoulders massive, exactly what we would expect. Right off, you know, no visible neck, 2/3 of the weight in the upper extremities, long arms, big hands, legs, you know, yeah, kind of muscular, whatever. That's kind of the profile, but it just looked, it was very top heavy comparatively, you know. And I'll never forget, you know, taking that imager off my eye was the hardest thing we had to do. And you remember, Cliff, full well, because you recorded it with it all the time, but having to put those X200 XPs on a bicycle helmet with the viewers and hold a backpack in front of you with a marine battery and the proprietary cord. And you guys, it's a nightmare. And I actually took the imager off my eye, ran. That's when I ran back to you. I just remember cussing at you, Cliff, just, you know, and you you reacted immediately. It was the quickest I'd ever seen. In 5 minutes, you had all that stuff on or less, and we're running back there. And I remember everyone was coming up, people, they had their headlamps on, kind of looking down the path, and I'm trying to get everybody just back, you know, because it's not their fault. They didn't know what was going on, you know. They just hear all the commotion, and I'm trying to explain to them. And in the meantime, you're back there, Cliff. And then when you came back, you're shaking your head, and I just kind of knew. And, you know, I did feel like that thing was, it was just waiting me out. You know, like, what a stealthy son of a bitch. Not give away your position. I'm not flashing a light on it. So technically I shouldn't be able to see it, you know? And as I said, that we pick up IR with our thermal, we don't give it off. So I think it knew I was there, was confused if I could see it or not. And it was just, it was just amazing to see how this thing, you know, would react under what I guess would be stress for it. When Paul Graves went back there, about what, a half hour later, I think it was, remember that night he's wearing a beanie and about 6'3", 170, you know, and I see, and that was like the second realization, because then I realized from that distance, the size, you know, it's with the depth perception, especially with those units, it wasn't always easy. And as you get more distant and, just seeing Paul with all his winter clothes on and a beanie and everything, it was just, oh my God. Cause you could see, even with the X200, you could see the hair patches on this thing. And I found out, you know, years later, going back every year, I'm just about, it ended up being about 32 yards is as close as I crept up to by the time I had taken that therm off my eye. So at least from that experience, you know, I know what we're looking for. I know what the money shot looks like, and it's going to look even better with, you know, the better technology we have now. So, but that really was, that incident really set up the mindset of how I research and going into the Sierras, looking for the vantage point. Cliff, as you like to say, where's the sniper going to be? That's exactly usually the biggest trees in play. These kind of things always stuck with me, and just hammer the vantage points and pay attention when no one else is. You know, it becomes inherent when you have an experience like that. So it was life-changing.
Did it move some ways that no human could move? The way, like you said, it looked like it was levitating at certain points, right? The way it held its torso.
It was the way that it shifted weight, like how it looked structurally. The upper extremities, I would say, was 2/3 of the weight, no doubt. Long arms, the shoulders were exactly what, you know, we've seen and we know they are, you know, just right off the head. The head was more rounder than I would have guessed, but it could have been sunken in a little bit because I never saw it face on from, I saw it from the back and then from the left side completely, but never head on. I mean, the thing just literally, I mean, just frozen like a statue, but I'm just looking at it and it's glowing. And that's why I always say, you know, with that and the Sierras, everything that I've seen, as crazy as it is, it makes sense to me. We are where we are. I just, between human beings, when that sun goes down and the way these things move and just how it's the shy, retiring nature, but the maneuverability. I mean, just the way they move. I think you even said it one time, Cliff, or I don't know if it was from a witness or you, but about moving like a spider. There's just this unique, it's like you know it when you see it.
How big did you think it was? Give us some dimensions and guesstimates on weight and height and all that.
You know, I knew because, you know, you guys know too, like with the depth perception, especially initially, we were still, you know, I don't want to say raw. I mean, we still use thermals a lot, but not like now, you know, we have a little bit better right. judge of things, but Paul Graves is really that was the model. Cause I know he's 6'3", 170, you know, he's got all his winter clothing, his beanie on. And I think the big realization of knowing, you know, I knew 110% what it was, but I'm seeing the realization where it was like, I started physically feeling it was after seeing him and realizing the actual size of the subject, the dimensions of the subject, and the like the agileness of the subject. It was like, and Paul, I mean, you can see all his clothing, you can see his beanie. I mean, this is because I got as close as 32 yards, you know, going back. I think it was 33 yards.
Yeah, it's real close.
As close as I got. Because I was kind of slowly creeping up, and I actually passed, you know, that little walkway that was up from where you guys were. I actually crept up enough to pass that, you know, just getting a better look. But God, I just, I'd do for one more opportunity. I would say the sun, it probably just under seven foot. And I would say weight-wise, the weight distribution, probably in the neighborhood between, not that good with weight, but 450 to 575 with two-thirds upstairs above the waist. It was an impressive specimen. But I would say a tad under 6'8", 6'9", call it. Yeah.
Shortly afterwards, didn't you do a couple recreation drawings of what you saw?
Yes, and that was your idea, Mr. Berrickman. We had a great trip back. I don't you remember. I mean, it was one of the great. I'll never forget that trip of our life. Like driving back, you and I back from Washington, Oregon, and you dropped me off with Shasta with my wife Kim's family, girlfriend at the time. But I'll never forget too. You looked over and you go, you know what? You told me you should draw it. Like you should just draw, you know, just get the different positions and the different. And I was like, yeah, you know, you're right. And so what I did is just kind of I got a photo of the area, did white out, so it's like a thermal impressionist view, and then I made the subject just like kind of what it was looking like from my perspective. And then I had at one point Canadian artist I loved, Brian Kundle. I love his work, and I just wanted him to make a commemorative piece for me, you know, just for my house. And he made this big, beautiful, portrait. I mean, he pretty much nailed it. It's pretty close.
I remember two of the drawings. I remember two of the positions that you put the thing in. Were there any more, or were there only two plus the really nice artistic commemorative one?
You know what? I did like eight or nine, actually. Yeah, they're on the BFRO. On that, I put a map. I put, you know, all the recreations. I mean, just, you know, as much as I could. And they're all there, but there's a couple much better than others. I could have took a little more time on it, but it gives you the idea of what it looked like from my perspective. You know, you give me a lot of good suggestions. That was one of the best. I appreciate that. Yeah, I'm glad. Yeah, we did that. And yeah, I mean, it's something that lives with me to this day and inspires me because it's like I know what the money shot looks like. I know it's attainable. I know we can get it, you know, and it's one of those things too that I wish, you know, I've been out with a lot of Bigfooters, you know, like you guys and awesome people, but it's one of those things that it's like, it's gotta be boring. It's gotta be, you know, in a way it's, you've got to be just tenacious and just keep, you know, just keep at it. You know, it's, you can't be reactive. If I would have been reactive in either instance, I don't even know anything exists. You know what I mean? It's like, you've got to, especially if you have thermal, I mean, you've got to use it. You know, and try to separate yourself a little bit, you know, and to your advantage.
I would say as far as thermal imaging and all that stuff, you're a good model for most people. You have a superpower in your hand. You have something magic in your hand, and it allows you to see in the dark, and they're not putting up to their eye. That thing should live on your eyeball because a Bigfoot isn't going to step out and let itself be known, and then you can raise the therm or the camera and then go ahead and shoot a picture of it or whatever. It's just not going to happen like that almost for sure. But what you're most likely going to see is like what you saw. The thing hiding from you off in the dark in the distance, and you're, oh, what is that? I better check this out. You spend a few minutes figuring it out, and you got lucky. It stepped out from behind the tree. But that's the thing. You got to look through these things. They don't do any good in your hand.
If you don't come back with a splitting headache and you're half blind, you didn't do it right.
Right. No matter what you're doing.
Our trip, Bo.
Yeah. I was surprised we didn't get footage that night because that was not the end of the Squatch action that night. I had to go take a dump like about half hour after this all happened. And I went out real close to where that thing was. I had my headlamp in my hand and a shovel and a little toilet paper, and I dug my hole and I'm squatting down. I'm just in the middle of my business. The thing starts running at me in the dark. I was so mad. I just yelled at him like, God damn it. I'm trying to take a crap here. And it just stopped. It had to weigh at least 350 pounds minimum. I mean, it didn't sound like an elephant, but it sounded big and it ran fast.
You did hear them around the tents though, right? That night.
Yeah. Well,
I could hear them through the tent. Like it was that. Well, and you hear these steps, and I'll never forget this point where this thing, started dumping rain and the tent flap. You know, it spilled over with water and it made like, you know, farting type noise, right? And it scared the one right outside the tent because you just hear it go and step, and you know, it just felt like the ground shook. And I was right there inside the tent just going, oh my God.
Yeah, awesome. Me and Jamie J were camping in his tent next to you with his little baby 9-month-old Cooper, and Cooper Loop was crying. When he started crying, those things came right into camp, and they were right outside our tents, and we could hear the footfalls. We actually heard some of the grumbling, mumbling. Couldn't make any words out. It was just blah, 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 you know, that kind of stuff. But we definitely
heard, it was like you could hear it. Yeah,
the breathing. Yeah, the there was two of them. Two of them were in the camp.
That's what I felt like too. I felt like I could hear two of them in the camp. And Cliff had the 250D. He had it perfectly. Cliff had it like parallel. It was right to the side, like right facing down the same pathway from where I saw it earlier. It's just in that, you know, at that time we had limited battery life and the thing never breached, you know, just didn't happen to breach. But I kept thinking, oh, we got it. Okay, this is going to justify everything I saw. It's in the bag. You know, it's like, no, it's not. You know, it ain't that easy. So, yeah. What a night, man. What a night.
And our situation has changed so much in these years, because back then we had thermal imagers, which is cutting edge technology, but they were archaic, you know, like crappy recording situations. It was a different situation back then. Had we what we have now, we would have a lot more to show for it.
Well, the first night we got used to that XP200 was when Wally came up with Moneymaker, I think 2005, or 2006. Okay. Yeah, 2006. And they drove up like 16, 17 hours through a huge storm. And Matt was so tired from driving all the way up, he was just going to pass out. And he gave us the thermal, but he goes, it's too complicated to hook up. I'm like, well, all right, we'll just go out. The first place I wanted to go, we stopped at a few spots. I go, I really want to go this one spot, Bart. We go there. I look off the bridge and I'm there. There's a giant one standing down at this boat pullout. It's a boat launch and pullout area on the Smith River. We're outside of Crescent City, and there's a big steelhead run going on, and the boats pull out there and they clean the fish and they just dump the guts there on the riverbank, and that's where this thing was standing, and that's another lost opportunity. I mean, with the thermals we have nowadays, we would have great. I mean, that thing was, because I went back and compared to people later on, it was about 9 foot tall and 3.5 feet across the shoulders at least. I remember
went up that hill like nobody's business, right up that hill, gone.
there was a stairway that's real steep that goes up one side. And there's also, if you go to the other end of the river bar, there's a real steep place to tow boats in and out. It didn't go up the walkway or the driveway. It went up the cliff.
No, that's exactly what it did. That's why now I look back and I'm like, yeah, that probably was one. I mean, what else could it have been? I mean, it was an upright. It had a tin of an upright shape too, because it was, you know, it was distant enough that, you know, you can't make out arms, legs, but you can see that it's not, you know, a quadruped. It didn't look like a quadruped. You know, it looked upright. You know, going. And especially now we have more experience looking back. I mean, we had used the thermals, but that was the first night. I mean, you and I, we were like two kids in a candy store. I mean, I think we got back. We used to have those things for like 8-9 hours nonstop. Yeah. It was just like, this is heaven. This is our dream right now. Yeah, it was great. Those are the days, boys. Those are the days.
People always say, where's the footage? And I'm like, trust me, it's very aggravating. You have to say we don't have it, because we could have had it a few times. And, you know, those opportunities are going to arise, if not for us, then somebody else that has the better equipment nowadays.
They keep showing up, you know, and the equipment now, if you get one of those FLIR TK Scouts, you know, they're not great resolution, but they cost $500. Oh, I mean, anybody, you know, with saving up a little money, you know, depending on their expenses, of course, can pick up one of those and bring it to the woods. And that's the key, man. The more technology and the more Bigfooters hands, and it's just a matter of time at this point.
I just, you know, it's funny too. I think back sometimes, and I think back like our early years, like 04 to 07, where we didn't have a lot happen those years. I think Bo had some good stuff happen, but it was just those years we had yams. Everyone, we built up all our friendships and we had some great times, even though we had not much happen. Those were some of the best times.
They set the foundation for the rest of our Bigfooting careers, really.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. It's just those years. I mean, it's just, yeah, they're precious. I think about them all the time when I'm up there.
One of the first things I had exciting happen when I was with Bart was Jamie J again when he and I saw that one up at Bluff Creek.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I think that was 07. And that was, I think that was either early summer or late spring 07. And we opened the roads to Bluff at that point. I think that was in Wales, I think. And we were at the T-shaped road. Leiterman and I were dug down as ticks. And we were listening. No one knew. We had no thermal. We had nothing. And I think I was playing a baby crying on the loudspeaker, my car.
You had a Sony night shot camera with infrared.
Yeah, exactly. You're not getting nothing. But I heard that thing walk in. You could hear this gravel crunching under the toes. It sounded like a biped to me, and the cautious walk and everything. And then, then we hear that Bo and Jamie, they thought it was me that recrossed the road, because they walked right past us, almost stepped on me and Robert, and then walked right past us all the way down. And just the way the shadows and the way the moonlight was, they solved, subject about my height, 6 foot or whatever, recross the road. We were never down there. So I was really fascinated. Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, I remember you were so frustrated. You're like, if you guys hadn't walked up right then, the thing was walking right towards us. You guys were so frustrated.
But we were, and you know what, though, looking back, I mean, without thermal, we weren't getting nothing. Come on.
Yeah.
There was just no way, I always think back to your guys' incident at that time, at some unnamed lakes in Northern California. You guys had a hell of an experience. And if you had thermal that night, you guys had them dead to light.
God.
We got therms just a year or two after that for the first time. And we thought, 3 months from now, we're going to have a couple pieces of footage. Yeah. We thought it was over. Yeah. But foolish.
We thought 2 weeks.
Yeah. Well, they were coming out in the open. I mean, they were coming out in the open, and that, so many things happened at the water spot. That's just ridiculous. And then it's just kind of shut down, unfortunately. But then again, I'm not really hitting it like I used to, because I back then I was living in Long Beach, California. So I would, spend a long time in the woods at the spots and stuff. But now I live in a spot, so it's harder for me to get down there. So it's probably just as good as it ever was, but
And people say that night that Jamie and I saw that one that was walking up on Bart and Robert, and said, well, you can't rule out a human. And I said, if you would have been on that road clearing mission, it took us 2 days to clear the roads to get in there, all the downed trees and boulders and mud. I remember
that. That was my first time to Bluff, actually. That was my first time there. Yeah.
That's something that burns me a little bit, man, because people who say that, you can't rule out a human, say, well, you weren't there. Like, how do you know that? I think it's pretty... I don't know. I mean, you guys camp. I mean, if you camp, you kind of know what's around you, especially at that spot. There's nowhere else to be at really near that spot. Right. You're going to go slinking around up and down hills off with no lights off trail. It's like, come on. You actually can eliminate humans from being one of the choices if you know the circumstances.
From a rational perspective. Yeah.
But yeah, skeptics are not exactly rational all the time. So.
I like that saying when you say some of them aren't smart enough to be skeptics.
That's true. Yeah, some people are not smart enough to be skeptics, and some people aren't qualified to be skeptics, and in various other ways. Absolutely.
And that's one thing too, in the field, now, I mean, don't get me wrong. I mean, my God, some of my best friends in the whole world are in this field. I love it. I mean, I love them. I love it. I love getting out. But and I'd love to go to more conferences, just even for the social aspect, for the people I care about. It's just hard to get away as much, and I want to use that time, maximize that time and get in the field. But it's just, with Facebook and everything else, it's just, I don't know. It just turns me out. Like, I almost feel like it's like I know what I'm looking for. You know what I mean? And I know the people that I like going out and searching with. And I just, these days that's where I try to put my energy when I have the time. It's just, I know this can be done. And I don't care who does it. I want it done. I know, Cliff, you're kind of like, or at least when we've talked before, I mean, they exist, and it's not the end of, for me though, I think it is. I think that I want it done before my parents go. Absolutely. I want them to, Like, it means so always supported me on that and everything that goes along with that. And I want it done. I don't care who it is. I just want it done, and I want it done right.
I agree. Yeah. It'd be great to get some redemption with our parents. That's for sure.
Oh yeah.
I don't care what your parents think of me.
They love you. Come on. They love you guys.
I remember when my parents met Cliff for the first time, they were like, "We're so glad you have a normal friend." And Cliff's like, "I'm your normal friend? Jesus."
I know. What the hell's wrong with you? Yeah, you told me I was the most normal guy that you knew. And I was thinking, well, God, in my circles, I was one of the stranger, but I don't know.
So, Bart, you're a multi-generational resident of, you know, Canada Row, Monterey Bay. And this show is called Bigfoot Beyond. I know you have some info on another one of our favorite cryptids, sea serpents.
Yeah. How crazy is this? So back in, I think it was the 50s, there was about a three-year period. Every Italian, Sicilian fisherman, I'm related to pretty much every one of them, including my Nanu, both Nanus, which were both my grandfathers. One of the, they saw this during the Steinbeck era, the sardine era, where they, there was about a 3 or 4 year period where they were just pulling in tons of sardines and then they just disappeared. It's like another whole mystery. But they were seeing, I think it might have been an oarfish. I probably not, because it was repeatedly seen. You're not going to repeatedly see an oarfish. That's how rare they are. But they, this thing was actually seen. I mean, but my not one non who saw it about 7 times. The other one only saw it 1 time. But every one of them saw it. And guess what the name of that thing was? The nickname.
Handsome Stud.
Well, pretty close. Turned out to be one of my better buddies, Bobo, which is pretty crazy. But yeah, that's what I grew up on was, and that was an inspiration for me in this pursuit, was my Nanu telling me the stories. And you know, he's so cute. He's such a great best, just old time Sicilian fisherman. I mean, just as you would imagine, you know, almost like the stereotype and the broken English, and he's just so cute best. And I just remember him always saying, "Eh, I go try to get the camera and go down," you know, and he would see it. He said on, you know, a lot of them had described like a horse's mane on it, you know, like a reddish horse. And that's where my mind is always looking towards, okay, what's the first, you know, what's the first candidate? And that matches up okay with an oarfish, but a lot of people described it shaped like a sunfish, not like a serpent, you know?
Mm.
And there was some really close-up sightings. There was a old Sicilian boat called the Dante Algeri. That had a major side, you know, all the whole crew saw this thing. And you got to remember, these guys are out all the time. These guys go to Alaska in June, July. They see it all. They see every sea life that you can, marine animal that you can possibly imagine. And, you know, when something's unfamiliar, these guys know it, you know. It's not like even, you know, your regular doe that's going to see something, you know, maybe at Loch Ness or whatever, not be able to identify it. I mean, these guys are out there all the time. So when something's different, you know, they know. So I don't know what the hell it was. The sightings tapered off. I think the last time my Nanu saw it might have been in the 60s. My Nanu Mangiapane. But yeah, that was it. I haven't heard anything since.
Well, let's do some speculation, because I think that's kind of fun. Sasquatch.
I like that.
What is it?
I would say that they are absolutely, no secret, masters of the environment. Chameleon-like abilities. They are, there's a shy and retiring nature. I don't know why. Maybe it's a disease thing with us. Maybe they have bigger maneuverable bodies, but somehow there's a shy and retiring nature attached, or we wouldn't be where we are. There's no argument on that. Why that is, I don't know. But I think it's a matter of time. And DNA may play a big part of it. You know, we had a long story there, but there was a couple opportunities for that. And I think the wrong person clearly take that ball and run with it, if you will. And it reflected back in her face. But I think in the long term, I think DNA, I think with thermal, there's now software, I'm being told, that they could see blood flow. That's, you know, technology is just going to keep going. And there's only 4%, about 4 to 5% of this continent that we officially take up that space. The other 95% is free. You know, there's darkness is how many hours? Once it's dark, those things can go wherever they want. And I've always had a theory that they've had the benefit, you know, just a lucky benefit of, you got to think in areas like where there's black bear and humans using a lot of those same trails. I just think a lot of their sign is disguised. because you got to remember, most people aren't the guy that smells the ground and he knows an elk crap there a week ago. You know, that's a rare guy. Most people are the people that take the path of least resistance in the forest, stick to the human trails. It's just no surprise where we are. I think the biggest thing that surprised me is one hasn't made a mistake and an actual body brought in for processing. That I baffled by. So I think it's just a matter of time. But I still think 10, 15 years. I still think we're out. I don't think it's going to happen tomorrow. I don't see it. I don't know what it is. I think there's still going to be some time before we get there.
I hope you're wrong.
So do I. So do I.
Right on, Bart. That was a great little chat with you. We appreciate you coming on the show.
No, I'm honored. Love you guys. And anytime you need anything from me, I'm here for you. So yeah. I appreciate it. Thank you for considering me and having me on. I'm honored.
Yeah, it doesn't even feel like a show. We're just hanging out talking like we're in the same room, but we're not.
Yeah.
And Bart, if you're available, we're going to do Bobo's Fab Five follow-up, where we'll pick the five best questions that the listeners have in the comment section and call you back and try to get some quick answers to clear up anything we didn't cover properly or didn't go into depth on enough.
Sure. Absolutely.
All right, Bart, man. Hey, man, great to talk to you. It's been a little bit too long. It's been a couple weeks first, I think, at least. It's always nice to hang out with you and Bobes at the same time. So thanks for coming on and gracing us with your presence.
Okay, Bart, love you too, brother. Thanks so much for joining us, and thanks, everyone, for tuning in and listening. And until next time, keep it squatchy.
Thanks for listening to this week's episode of Bigfoot and Beyond. If you liked what you heard, please rate and review us on iTunes. Subscribe to Bigfoot and Beyond wherever you get your podcasts, and follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Bigfoot and Beyond Podcast. You can find us on Twitter at Bigfoot and Beyond, that's an N in the middle, and tweet us your thoughts and questions with the hashtag Bigfoot and Beyond.